The Republicans' Week in the Spotlight comes to a close tonight in Cleveland. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Media coverage has been wall-to-wall in the evenings, but before each night's speeches, days have been filled with visits, meetings, and politicking. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies has been following the proceedings at the RNC and joins us once again from Cleveland. Now, Dave, the Pennsylvania delegation in particular has received some high-level visitors, including vice presidential nominee Mike Pence. To what extent is this an indication of its importance as a swing state?
Well, it's certainly an indication of that, Dave. You know, this is a state that the Trump campaign has targeted as a winnable battleground state, and they've had party luminaries coming to visit the delegation all week. Monday, it was House Speaker Paul Ryan. Tuesday, Jeff Sessions, the senator who gave Trump's nominating speech, and Donald Trump Jr. himself was here, that is to say, with the Pennsylvania delegation, talking about how he'd learned to hunt in Pennsylvania and loved the place. The vice presidential pick, Mike Pence stopped by today. Didn't stay long, but certainly did his best to make friends. Here's one example. In this case, he's talking about Hillary Clinton and what Republicans say is her determination to destroy the coal industry.
We don't need a president who promises to put coal miners and coal companies out of work. We need a president who will advance American energy independence on all of the above. And I promise you, Trump digs coal.
You know, it's interesting, Dave. Our health and science reporter Mike and Scott emailed me and asked if there'd been any discussion of the environment here. Now, that's about as close as it comes, I think. But, you know, Pence promised he and Trump would campaign shoulder to shoulder with all those delegates in all four corners of the state. Republicans have not carried this state for president since 1988. That's a 28-year losing streak. And it may not be easy to break it. You know, the Trump campaign has not yet been advertising here. Hillary Clinton has been, and her super PAC has been. The Trump campaign still doesn't have the kind of regional fundraising network here or any real campaign organization. No press contact, for example. Literally nobody I can call. So they've got some work to do.
Dave, let's take up that notion of shoulder to shoulder in the broader sense. There's the question of party unity or lack thereof.
Oh, that's a huge question, Dave. And you, of course, saw it last night when Ted Cruz essentially upstaged the vice presidential speech by giving a speech that did not endorse the candidate, provoking that thunderous torrent of boos. You know, last night I tracked down the one Pennsylvania delegate who refused to vote for Trump in the roll call Tuesday night. His name is Doug Brubaker from Lancaster County. We spoke after that speech, and he was pretty ticked off about the acrimony in the hall and this, you know, public display of party disunity.
There was 400-some-odd Cruz supporters in there and probably more. There is a lot of friction under the surface here, and I'm embarrassed and disappointed.
Now, he's one kind of disaffected Republican, a lot of conservative Cruz supporters who are angry at Trump. There are others, you know, more moderate Republicans who think Trump is too provocative or erratic, that his pronouncements about Muslims and Mexicans are divisive and inhibit the party's ability to reach out. Remember, more than half of Pennsylvania's congressional delegation didn't even come to the convention. So there's a big question about party unity. You know, I guess the other side of the argument is that if you have a candidate who is incredibly charismatic and transformative, you don't need that.
We are now just a few hours out from the grand finale, Donald Trump's speech. What are the expectations?
The most entertaining thing would be if Trump accidentally plagiarized a Barack Obama speech. I don't think anybody expects that. Nobody knows what to expect of Donald Trump. Yesterday, I was at the delegation's hotel, and I saw Congressman Lou Barletta, one of Trump's earliest and most enthusiastic supporters in Pennsylvania, talking to some reporters. You'll remember that Barletta was the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, who made headlines over controversial measures against undocumented immigrants. Anyway, he was being asked, do you think Trump will say something provocative, like his statement about banning Muslim immigration? Here's what he said.
The art of the deal, that's what Donald Trump is about. So he brings up an issue that catches everyone's attention. Everyone has to stop and pause because of something Donald Trump said. And after you get over the initial shock value of what he said, we then begin to have a debate on the issue that he's bringing up.
So that's one friendly view of Trump's approach. Remember that the candidate's speech is normally just about the only thing voters will remember from a convention. I think it would be a victory for this campaign if they just get through this without another misstep or distraction.
Dave, hope you get through it. Safe travels coming back to Philly. Let's do this all over again next week.
All right, Dave. Take care.
Meanwhile, the Philadelphia Host Committee for the Democratic National Convention is fighting to keep its fundraising records private. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports that a judge heard arguments today in a case brought by an independent journalist seeking the documents under the state's Right to Know law.
Specifically, Dustin Slaughter wanted to see the financial reports the DNC host committee is required to file with the city in exchange for a $15 million line of credit to help cover the costs of the event.
In light of the fact that the host committee is still short on their fundraising goals and that $15 million could come into play, the public has a right to know immediately what's happening behind the scenes.
Last month, the state's Office of Open Records ordered a city agency to release the records. However, the host committee appealed to the Court of Common Pleas. Attorney David Patinsky says making the finance reports public could compromise efforts to finish raising the $60 million needed for the DNC.
They want the information before the convention starts. And we are going to take advantage of the federal legislation, which gives us the right to file it no later than 60 days. It's very simple.
Slaughter and his attorney argue the reports became public documents once they were filed with the city. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
The Pope's visit last September was an historic moment for Philadelphia, though for many businesses it wasn't exactly a lucrative one. Now with the DNC rolling into town, local restaurants hope they'll get a bigger cut this time around. More from WHYY's Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Everyone in the Philly restaurant industry has a Pope story. Very few of them have happy endings.
I was standing on an East Passyunk with the chef owner of Townsend, the chef owner of Nord, and the chef owner of Fond.
That's Francis Creto Cretarola. He's the co-owner of Lever 2 and Brigantessa, a couple of trendy Italian joints, both located on perhaps the hottest dining block in the city, except when the Pope wheeled into town last September, in which case it wasn't so hot.
We were standing on East Passyunk having a beer on a Saturday at 9 o'clock because our businesses were almost empty. I mean, there was a lot of sort of whistling past the graveyard kind of laughter and joking about it, but yeah, no, I mean, we count on that.
Restaurateurs have a lot of theories for why the Pope visit flopped. Some say the city scared locals out of town. Others say pilgrims just aren't the type who dine out. Regardless of cause, lots of folks still feel burned, which begs the question, how are restaurants eyeing the DNC?
I think people are cautiously optimistic.
The DNC host committee estimates the convention will generate between $250 and $300 million for the regional economy. Ben Feleccia, president of the Philadelphia Hotel and Restaurant Alliance, believes some of that will trickle into restaurant cash registers.
We know that there's 40 to 50,000 folks going to be in town that week, which is a great amount of people.
To compare, the Secret Service says 1 million people pass through the security lines during the papal weekend. So Feleccia is not ready to predict a bonanza.
It's the same amount of people as a preseason Eagles game.
From a restaurant's perspective, the DNC is a little bit of a puzzle. It's not cumbersome enough to shut down major roadways like the Pope visit did, and political types are expected to spend big. But there's concern that the convention hours, 5 to 11 every night, will leave eateries barren during the dinner rush.
I was here during the Republican convention when there was also a lot of hype, and when I look back at my records from 2000, the month of July was no different than any other July in the history of 20 years of being open.
Ellen Yin co-owns a quartet of Philadelphia restaurants, including Fork in Old City. Asked to describe her reservation book for the week of the DNC, she offers one word.
Light.
She has, however, been able to rent out Fork for a trio of prepaid breakfasts. Places around town are banking on these so-called buyouts from delegations and lobbyists to juice their bottom line.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That includes McGillan's Old Ale House in Center City, which opened in 1856, the year Philly hosted the first ever Republican National Convention. To get ready for this year's convention, co-owner Chris Mullins has plastered his pub in political paraphernalia.
The taller donkeys are all old Jim Beam bottles going back through. You can see, like, here's 1980.
Mullins knows folks still have a hangover from last year's papal letdown.
And I hope that the Pope experience didn't negatively affect people's planning. I mean, if we come off like we don't care, then in the future, events like this may think twice. We want to come to Philadelphia if we are not going to roll out the red carpet.
Mullins thinks the convention could boost his profits 20 to 30%. But the real value of the DNC, he says, won't be measured in 1 week's worth of receipts. It'll be measured in how it enhances the city's image.
This event, it sets the tone for the next 10 to 15 years.
And when you've been open for 160 years, taking the long view doesn't sound so crazy. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera, WHYY News.
The historic Curtis Building in Philadelphia's Washington Square neighborhood is undergoing renovation, converting its office spaces into condominiums. But last week, the city's Department of Licenses and Inspections halted the project because of damage to a work of art. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on a new plan to protect the priceless glass mural.
The mural, called Dream Garden, was made a century ago by the artists Maxfield Parrish and Lewis Comfort Tiffany. It's big, 49 feet long, made entirely of tiny glass tiles. That's what makes it so vulnerable, says Mary McGill, an art conservator.
Because it's made of so many very small individual pieces of glass, and they were so fastidiously chosen to make that image, it is very vulnerable to, I think, vibrations, more so than a painting, which might just be on a piece of canvas glued to the wall.
McGill works for the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, which owns Dream Garden. It's permanently installed inside the east lobby of the Curtis Building. It cannot be removed. When a demolition crew began working on the building a few months ago, it caused structural vibrations, and Dream Garden cracked. Some of the tiles came loose. The city's Department of Licenses and Inspections ordered work to stop. And now that order is being lifted because PAFA and the building owners have come up with a plan to protect the glass mural. McGill has devised a temporary wall to be built in front of it, pressing foam panels against the mural surface to hold in place any tiles that may loosen.
If a vibration happens, the wall will continue to react to the vibration and could shake more pieces loose. And our scheme, the plan we have in place, is to hold them in place.
The value of the mural is not determined, but 15 years ago, the Pew Charitable Trust paid $3.5 million to make sure it stayed in the city. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, more than 1,200 writers are ready to meet on the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art to share their thoughts on the presidency, with one caveat.
They're all too young to vote. It's that we're talking about kids ages 7 to 17.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Democratic National Convention and related protests are not the only gatherings in town pondering the presidency. On Tuesday, potentially thousands of participants will convene on the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art to tackle the topic, If I Were President. Organizing the effort and joining me to explain is Tim Whitaker, Executive Director of Mighty Writers. Tim, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here.
Let's note that all of these participants are too young to vote.
They're all too young to vote. It's that we're talking about kids ages 7 to 17 all across the city in every neighborhood, organized by Mighty Writers to show up July 26, 10 a.m., steps to the Art Museum.
And if enough participants show, it'll apparently be entered in the Guinness Book of Records.
That's correct. If we get the number of kids we need, it will be a world record.
For what event?
Most kids, same place, writing at the same time.
Now, what's the current record you're trying to top?
The current record is, there's a little confusion on the Guinness side about this, but it appears to be 1,200 and change in China, 2003.
So how's it going to work? All these 1,200 plus kids will be gathered around a chalkboard?
They will all have pads and paper and pens that we will supply them with, as well as water and T-shirts and all kinds of other stuff. When we tell them to start writing, they'll start writing for 20 minutes, and then we'll collect all the notebooks and see if we set a record.
Talk about summer school. Yeah. Sounds like fun, but it's a serious endeavor.
Well, the idea is to shine a light on the literacy crisis in Philadelphia and nationally as well, to get people to start to care about the written word again, which has really taken a backseat to math, science, standardized tests. Writing just doesn't seem to have the place in the world that it once had, and we're trying to do something about that.
Mighty Writers formed, I believe, in 2009. What successes have you seen to date, and what are the challenges with budget after budget calling for the diminishment of education, specifically in the Philadelphia district?
Well, we see more than anything else, we have four sites in West Philly, North Philly, South Philly, and we have a bilingual site for the Mexican community and the Italian market. And what we see is when the kids are there for some period of time, usually 3 to 6 months, we see their personality change. We see their self-esteem really start to soar. We see all kinds of personality changes, confidence, and all of that comes from self-expression, I believe. You know, we have other data that we look at in terms of report cards and a software program. The kids write into that, and we see what their scores are. But the thing I look at, the thing I feel is the best indicator is the self-esteem.
This started in Philadelphia. It's a Philadelphia program. Is it part of similar-minded and styled programs in other major metropolitan areas?
There are not many programs like this as far as I know. There is one program that I visited very early on called 826, which started in San Francisco by Dave Edgars. They do some along the same lines of what we do. But I don't see any programs that are exactly what we do, which is a very intensified writing program.
To what extent is this an extension of what you once upon a time did as a fifth and sixth grade teacher?
Right after college, I taught school for a couple years, and I was really bad at it. I was really, really immature, not ready for it. Kids sort of ran all over me, but it stuck with me. I like being around kids, so I went into journalism for 30 years. When that stopped being fun, I thought, what do I want to do? I thought, you know, I really like being around kids. Keeps you young. And so that's how the program started.
The topic, if I were president,
exactly.
Is it just to answer and finish that sentence, or are you looking for a whole agenda?
Well, you know, it's ages 7 to 17, so the kids that are 7 will settle for, you know, a couple of well-crafted sentences about this. The kids that are older were looking for something a little deeper. We have one kid that said to me, I said, what are you going to write about? And she said that she wanted to invite the Obamas, the whole family, every Saturday night for dinner so she could learn what to do.
Every Saturday night.
Every Saturday night.
Tim, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
I enjoyed it, Dave. Thanks.
Tim Whitaker, Executive Director of Mighty Writers, and you can learn more about that organization at mightywriters.org. The Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival began 25 years ago at DeSales University, just north of Quakertown, with The Taming of the Shrew as its first production. The festival's fourth staging of the play is now running, and Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro wonders what we're to make of this comedy that celebrates the submission of women.
Kate, the rotten-tempered woman in question, is never actually struck by Petruchio, the man who decides to wed her for a big challenge and a bigger dowry. Instead, she's starved, publicly shamed, psychologically manipulated, and essentially held captive. When Shakespeare wrote The Taming of the Shrew about 425 years ago, only one woman was apparently allowed to be headstrong, and she ran the British Empire. The problem here is, for all its outdated intolerance and running vein of sexism, The Taming of the Shrew is a stunning piece of playwriting. Depending on the director's choices, it's funny, fast, and wonderfully written, yet still highly offensive, especially in its final scene when, spoiler alert, Kate delivers a speech about the many duties of women to their men. There's no getting around that sexist scene. It might send you out laughing in ridicule, or maybe even angry. The production features plenty of physical acting, especially between Ian Merrill Peaks as Petruchio and Eleanor Handley's Kate. In a version by New York's Public Theater this summer in Central Park, a cast of all women intentionally made the play so offensively sexist, all you could do was laugh. They also found a cunning way to turn the ending around by uttering every word Shakespeare wrote in that last scene, then singing The Who's rebellious My Generation. At the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival, they also break into song after the final scene. Whether that song even comments on the text that went before it, I can't say. On opening night, the lyrics came across as one huge garble, overpowered by the instruments the cast was playing. It was the single major flaw at a point when the production calls out for dynamic clarity. The Taming of the Shrew runs at the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival through August 7th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
And that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. With the Republican convention wrapping up, the Democrats will next look to display party unity. And tomorrow evening, we'll check in with some Bernie Sanders supporters to see how they're leaning. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.